Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to The Critic podcast. Is this COVID's second wave? And if it is, how worried should we be? In this podcast, The Critic's political editor Graham Stewart talks to the investor and statistician Alistair Hames about whether the data really stacks up for a resurgence of COVID-19.
Alistair Hames, in early July this year, there were about 300 to 500 new cases in the UK every day. Now there's a double that, sometimes more than double that. There's about 1,000 new cases of COVID-19 a day. Is this the second wave?
Well, I get very nervous trying to make predictions about where we are in the various trajectories of the epidemic based on cases. I think using cases as the prime metric has been very, very problematic throughout. In the early days, it was throttled by the lack of availability of testing. Then we've muddied the waters further by introducing different pillars of testing, whereby rather than just testing sick people, we test NHS workers, then mass surveillance testing. And then it's been further polluted by contact tracing, where you would expect to find more cases, although asymptomatic. And at no point really have we been able to compare, you know, a single month or really hardly a single week's figures with the previous ones. So I think using cases to work out where we are in the wave or second wave is very, very problematic. I think better data to use, and we talked about this maybe the last podcast back in May, I think. We have some harder figures that won't be throttled by the availability or protocol of testing. We have the triage calls, which is people calling 111 or 999 or using 111 online. And that would be, you know, a precursor to people turning up ill at hospital. We have hospital admissions. We have the people who are hospitalised, admitted to intensive care, and finally we have deaths. And all of those, as it were, harder bits of data have all been consistently pointing in the right direction, you know, since the spring. There's been absolutely no hint of a second wave in any of those bits of data, despite protests and riots and celebrations. Everything has been consistently pointing in the right direction, and it's only if you use cases that there would be any hint of a resurgence. But then it's much more to do with the fact that when areas are locked down, there's mass testing in those areas. People are encouraged, or they've got no symptoms whatsoever and haven't even been contact traced, they're encouraged to get tested. And, you know, throughout this epidemic, where you test, you find. So I think the only suggestion that there's any second wave in the UK is if you look at cases. And if you just don't look at cases, there's absolutely no indication of a second wave. I mean, we don't look at cases for influenza during the summer because we know it spreads, but it doesn't make people ill. But for some reason, we do seem to be looking at them for COVID, which I've
It's very interesting, isn't it, that whatever measure of statistics we use to seemingly show an increase in the number of cases, the number of deaths, both in the UK and in Europe, is much lower than it was in earlier peaks back in March and April. We are, in England and Wales, I mean, we've been looking at about, over the last few weeks, about 20 deaths a day. Yes. Why is it then that the death rate is so low? Is it, you know, as you've just been discussing, we're wrong to be looking at cases as the measure, or is it actually that the virus has mutated into something less serious?
Well, on that latter point, I'm not the guy to ask. I'm not a virologist or an immunologist. Just reading Twitter from people who are, they say there is, in general, not very much sign of any mutation. And as I understand it, coronaviruses mutate much slower than, for example, influenza viruses. I think there has been talk of a less virulent strain starting to spread in Asia, but I don't really follow all that, to be honest. I mean, one thing you can say is that if you look at the curves death data by the date that people actually died rather than when it makes it through the vagaries of reporting, you get an entirely predictable, slightly lopsided bell curve. And it's exactly the same curve whether you look at it in Spain or the UK or Sweden or certainly northern US, the northern states of the US that were hit early. It is an identical curve. And it would suggest to me that it's simply the virus working its way through the population, and the decrease in the growth rate of the figures of people dying, slightly technical, but basically shows you how quickly the epidemic is decelerating, has been fairly constant throughout. So I think the default assumption here should always have been that it's a virus that's working its way through a population as they do. It gradually finds it harder and harder to find susceptible people. Firstly, because there are fewer susceptible people because people have been infected. And secondly, because it will tend to hit first the people who are, as it were, more sociable and have more social interactions first. And gradually it finds it harder and harder to find the nooks and crannies that it hasn't yet reached. So I think the default assumption would have to be that it's just worked its way through. And, you know, it's a phrase that I think people have stopped using slightly out of embarrassment, but the initial herd immunity conversations we were having in the spring, it does sort of look like that's what it's doing. Maybe not herd immunity, and maybe better ways to think about it would be it's just reached saturation. You know, at a certain point, the sponge sort of can't hold any more water, and the population has just sort of been fully saturated with the virus.
So if that was to be the case, then countries like the UK and Sweden should be in a much better position than countries like Australia and New Zealand, which have, at great cost to personal liberty, been successful at keeping the virus out of their countries, largely successful keeping the virus out of their countries in the first place. They are therefore still very much at risk.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been incredibly successful because they locked their countries down before the virus could really get in. But the problem in doing that, obviously, is you maintain a fully susceptible population. And unless you want to keep yourself locked off from the rest of the world forever, that the virus is going to find its way in, and it will take its toll as they go around. But doubtless they'll argue that by the time it does, treatment protocols will be further advanced. Maybe there'll be a vaccine that makes a significant difference, and they will have bought themselves some time. But yeah, they'll have a fully susceptible population, and we won't. But just coming back to the UK and Sweden, I mean, the one I'm a real kind of optimist on these things, but the one thing that gives me a bit of caution about the UK and Sweden is that these respiratory viruses do tend to follow a very strong seasonal pattern. This is the case for influenza. And it's a very, very predictable every flu season. And, we haven't seen this coronavirus before, so we don't really know what kind of pattern it will follow. But if it were to follow the same pattern as a flu, then we would have expected it to start subsiding when it subsided. And we might be fearful that it might start to come back when the influenza viruses come back in, let's call it sort of around November time. So I don't think we can really sort of rest easy and say that there won't be any significant second wave until we've made it sort of into the winter. Maybe not through the winter, but if we get to sort of mid-winter and there's no significant second wave, albeit there's bound to be a few local clusters and outbreaks, I think it's not until then that we'll know that the herd immunity / saturation theory is correct. And in fact, you see this exact issue in America at the moment, because if you were just to look at figures for the USA as a whole, you might well think that the US is going through a second wave. It looks like a kind of double humped dromedary, the case and death pattern. But actually, the US is really more like a continent. The northern states have got a completely different sort of weather pattern and a different pattern the way people live than the southern states. The temperate states are very difficult to the subtropical ones. And if you were to overlay the patterns of coronavirus in those different geographies, as it were, with the patterns of influenza in those geographies. It's absolutely identical. So coronavirus hit fairly late in the influenza year. And so just as Sir Patrick Vallance and John Giesecke were saying back in spring, it's really going to take, you know, maybe 18 months until we really know the patterns of the virus. So I'm just a tiny bit cautious there. But in terms of this particular wave, it looks like it's just done, basically. If you look at Sweden, the UK, New York City, all the places that were hit really hard, there hasn't been any hint of a second wave. So if that's it, then it's done. But I think we just need to be a little bit cautious because of the seasonal patterns for other respiratory viruses.
It's often said that the pattern of COVID-19 could well be mimicking that of the so-called Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, which had three main phases. How useful is that 1918 experience? And if it's not, what would be the historical examples you would, from a statistician's point of view, you would draw attention to?
Yeah, well, on the Spanish flu, that's an interesting one because, as I understand it, the really lethal wave there, which was the second wave of the three, there still seems to be disagreement in the the books and the papers I've read of whether that was simply, as it were, a true second wave of the same virus. In other words, it was as if we'd sort of squashed the sombrero, as Boris Johnson said, and then it was people let up. They thought it had gone, and because of the summer, meaning that, you know, influenza just doesn't make people in summer, basically, that's what people think of as a true second wave. In which case, that would be the kind of thing that, like I was saying 5 minutes ago, that might just give us a little bit of pause. But as I understand it, the 1919 wave was just a huge mutation. And there's even debate about whether it's a completely separate virus that came in or whether it was such a significant mutation of the 1918 H1N1 virus that it was knocking over people who'd had the virus the year before. So you could get Spanish flu twice within a year, which is, you know, that's not a good time. The truth is, it's just too early to tell. We've got a completely typical epidemic curve for coronavirus. Regardless of whether there was a lockdown or not, regardless of whether people wore masks or not, there is just a particular curve, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, that this virus makes. But, you know, at the moment, we don't know what's going to happen, come the next winter. We've never seen this virus go into a winter before. If I had to sort of bet money, I would probably bet money that there might be slightly more outbreak in the winter, more localized outbreaks in winter. But so many people must have been exposed to this now. It's gone into so many other nooks and crannies that I simply can't believe there'll be, you know, a serious second wave, barring any mutation. But, you know, if I were to put money on that, I wouldn't put that much money on it.
There was a serious flu outbreak that hit Britain in 1969. Is that relevant, or should we be treating that as a historic event which has no real bearing on the situation we face now?
Yeah, well, that 1969 flu killed about 80,000 people in the UK off a much smaller population. And let's bear in mind that that's roughly twice what coronavirus has taken in England. You know, we might want to just reflect on the fact that life went on completely as normal. I spoke to my parents; neither of them could actually remember the 1969 flu, and I tried to have a conversation with them about it. But it clearly didn't leave that big an imprint on people, That was also, I believe, an H1N flu. They seem to be the really nasty ones. Certainly, H1N1 flu was one of the viruses that became part of the cocktail, which was swine flu in 2009. And H1N1 virus is still going around now. You know, we get vaccinated for it every year. It's still going around every year. I think we're on the 102nd wave. So before we get too exercised about the second wave of coronavirus, it's probably worth remembering that all of these influenza viruses, we have vaccines, they still go around every year. Vaccines are very, very rarely a panacea. In fact, just within years that we'll remember, Graham, 2000 flu was a really, really bad year. Yeah, that winter there was more deaths per capita than the peak of COVID, and I don't recall anyone really talking about bad flus in 2000. There was no suggestion of millennium celebrations being cancelled. I think everyone was more worried about Y2K at the time. I think what has changed this year is the availability of information, and so we've I do think we've slightly blown things out of proportion.
Well, I want to pick up on that point. 2000 wasn't so very long ago. Even 1969 is just in my life. How is it that the attitude, not just of the British government, but of the vast majority of governments worldwide, has changed? I mean, you say there's more information around. Is that all there is to it? What has been the role of the WHO in this? And or is it just that once when one country does something very protective of its population, other governments feel they will be judged by that yardstick and must do the same?
Gosh, this is going to be a chapter or two of the inevitable book, isn't it? I mean, one thing is we have possibilities that we didn't have then. So we can now say we're going to close down schools and have online learning for a term. That was plainly impossible even 5 years ago. And because it can be done, then inevitably it's on the table. We just want to work out how to react to these things. I mean, if you couldn't do tuition by Zoom, I very much doubt that children would still be off school now, let alone talking about them missing further school. And same for work. You know, you just run roughly a 5-month experiment of the vast majority of people who work in offices working from home. I mean, plainly that would not have been possible even 5 years ago. But because it's possible, you know, it's on the table when you're working out how to react to these things. The other thing we have is, you know, because of the free availability of information, as soon as there's an opinion poll run, it's shared around the internet, pressure's put on MPs, and before you know it, the pressure is, it can't be resisted. We seem to now have effectively government by opinion poll, and I just can't imagine some of the great governments of the past running opinion polls before deciding how to react to these things. I mean, plainly, the UK government has changed its decision on how to react at various points of this epidemic, based on what the opinion polls were saying, right back to the original lockdown. You know, mid-March, it was very clear what the government's path was going to be here. And then there was sort of mass clamouring in the press. And then there was the first of many pivots. So, you know, if we want a very clear telegraphing of what government policy will be now, we just have to look at the opinion poll and you can set your watch. Now, that wouldn't have been a possibility before there was opinion polls and they were shared on social media. And governments are always going to react to what they know the public wants. So there's all kinds of sort of societal changes that make this a heady brew. And if you overlay that with the fact that we haven't had a true war that's been on the front pages for an awfully long time, we've had quite a few very mild winters, and so risk has just not been on people's agenda for a long time. Maybe there's other parts of psychology that would be worth exploring. For example, anyone who works in an office knows that there's a health and safety officer. You can go through life thinking you're taking no risk at any point. I think previous generations just knew that everything you do in life, you're always taking risk. And so maybe there's all kinds of constituent parts of modern society that have made a perfect sort of petri dish for this epidemic to be dropped into.
There's a popular narrative emerging which goes something like this: the British government locked down a little bit later than it should have, maybe a week or two earlier. Because of that, and the decision to empty the hospitals, to empty them of untested, elderly, vulnerable people into care homes, we had the shockingly high rate of deaths in care homes. That, and we are living with that legacy now. So, you know, if only the government had acted both earlier and more sensibly, we wouldn't now have this kind of long shadow of other policies taking place, limiting our ability to go about our lives normally. Which parts of that narrative ring true to you, and which parts strike you as mistaken?
Well, so I think we locked down from memory on March the 23rd. So if we're talking about a week or two earlier, we're talking about maybe second week or so of March. I think that would have made absolutely no difference whatsoever. You know, I think that the last time at which we could have locked down and, as it were, gone down the New Zealand route of trying to go for what's called zero COVID now, I think the last time that could have possibly have worked would have been roughly half term before everybody, you know, went abroad, went skiing and so forth. But then we're talking about mid-February. You know, we're talking about roughly around Valentine's Day. So that's roughly a month before, you know, before the earlier lockdown that people are now saying we should have done. I think it was by the time it was on the agenda, it was already far, far too late. For something this infectious, this easy to spread, you know, with this much asymptomatic spread, all the things we talked about on the last podcast that makes it so difficult to test and trace. You know, the last time you could have got around all those problems really was mid-February, and it was already too late, unfortunately. You know, it was already so well seeded through the population by the time it was on the agenda that it was always too late. And if we had tried to lock down, we'd have locked down from the wrong countries. I mean, doubtless we would have locked down from China. And in fact, the people tracing the genetic makeup of the different strands of the virus circulating in the country, it's quite clear. In fact, Neil Ferguson pointed this out, that most of the viral strains in the country actually came from France, Spain, and Italy. So even if we had locked down, it would have been probably a month too late anyway, and we'd have locked down from the wrong country. So it was, by the time it was on the agenda, it was inevitable. So that part I don't agree with. Should we have just effectively done the original Patrick Vallance plan of throwing a true protective ring around the vulnerable, the people particularly in the care homes? Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And there was absolutely no defence for discharging knowingly infected people or untested people from hospitals into care homes. There's absolutely, that never made any sense. And, you know, whoever is behind that policy is, I don't know how they're going to argue. In the inevitable inquiry coming down the tracks, they're going to have to spend a long time trying to work out their justification for that, because clearing the beds without testing, that is what has, in my belief, I think that's what led to the very high death toll.
Another aspect that the government invested much hope in was the test and trace technology, which hasn't worked in the way that it was hoped. Has that really made much of a difference in your view?
No, I don't think it has really. I mean, it's an incredible waste of money. I think they're up to about 10 billion, I read, which absolutely is absolutely befuddling. You know, they've obviously gone down the route of trying the wrong technology. I mean, trying to use Bluetooth for this is absolutely daft. I can sit at home and I can pick up my neighbour's Bluetooth devices and they can pick up mine. So, you know, have we just had contact if this app were to work? It's absolutely farcical. And there's all the problems that we talked about on the last podcast, whereby from everything we know about this virus, the way that most people have it asymptomatically, and you have a very short time in which to trace the number of people that they may have in turn infected. It was just never worth going down the contact tracing route from everything we know about the virus. I think it was always a red herring. And unfortunately, from having, you know, as it were, nailed their colours to the test and trace mask, the main thing that the government's lost is reputation for competence. And, you know, and because they created expectation, that then leads to unions demanding that the thing is up and running, even though I think if you looked at the basic facts of the virus and the disease, you should never have gone down that route. Particularly when they were, you know, you're largely testing and tracing the healthy. So if you're constantly finding and asking to isolate, you know, healthy 20-year-olds, you know, those are never the people who are going to be ill anyway. So you're not saving anybody from going to hospital, let alone dying. Now, having said that, you know, if we just kind of riff on this contact tracing idea a little bit, I think a natural development of it is going to be what Matt Hancock is now talking about, which is mass surveillance testing, the next sort of outgrowth of the ONS's surveillance testing. And this actually, I think, is maybe a little bit more promising, depending on how they use it. Because if we know, let's say there is another resurgence come the autumn, come the winter. If we know whereabouts in the country it's a problem, and we can get increasingly localized, you know, not just to Birmingham, which is that's way too big an area, for example, but you know, particular areas, maybe particular districts, then once we know where the virus is actually circulating in numbers, what we can do then is isolate the vulnerable there. You know, not lock down schools or close restaurants or shops, or you know, not really have any interruption to, as it were, normal life. Because what we really want is for the virus to be circulating so that the healthy are immune and then won't be infecting the vulnerable. But when we know where the virus is, those are the areas where we can lock down the vulnerable. So the people that we know who ought to be shielding in the areas where the virus is circulating, in a very targeted way, we can say to them, look, you need to shield or cocoon for the next 3 weeks. The people in the care homes, okay, unfortunately, we have to stop visitors for the next month. You know, to the extent we can stop the care homes getting agency staff for 3 or 4 weeks, maybe can be very, very targeted there in protecting the vulnerable, the people who would actually get ill if they get the virus. And if that's the way that the government will be able to use the mass surveillance testing, then I think that will be all to the good. But contact tracing healthy people as a way of interrupting something that's so widespread, I think that was always a bit of a red herring.
So your message is, in essence, protect the vulnerable and let the rest of us go about our daily life as we used to in the good old days.
Yes, and that's a paraphrase of exactly what Patrick Vallance was saying on about the 15th of March. You know, he went on Sky saying more or less exactly that. He had other people, you know, appearing on Newsnight saying exactly that. And for some reason, we didn't stick with it. And I can see why, with you know the television scenes and the diminishing NHS capacity, I can see why they bottled it. But with the benefit of hindsight, plan A was always the right plan.
Well, one day the Patrick Vallance memoirs will make for very interesting reading, particularly if they are candid. In the meanwhile, Alistair Hames, thank you very much for talking us through your crunching of the numbers and your perspective on where we are with coronavirus.
Thank you very much, Greg.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.